Okay, this is Bible 241. It is March 25th, and we're going to finish up endocrine system today. And don't forget, next week you do have exam 3. It's going to be a week from today, and that's April 1st, and that's chapters 9, 10, and 11. Any questions on that? No. Okay. Very good. What about any questions on endocrinology? Any questions on endocrinology? So far, no? Okay, I need to go over the pituitary a bunch today and then talk about a couple other things. So let's see, last time we were talking about the structure of the pituitary. Sometimes we don't cover the structure in enough detail in anatomy for physiology to make sense, so I'm going to go over some additional structures depending on your lab instructor. But I think last time we talked about where is the pituitary gland located? It is underneath the hypothalamus. It's below the hypothalamus. What bone is it associated with? Yeah, the sphenoid. Remember the cella turcica? There's a fossa, the cella turcica, that holds the sphenoid. I mean, that holds the pituitary. And so the pituitary is just right on the other side of the sphenoid sinuses, which are that kind of make up the roof of the mouth and the back, or actually part of your nasal cavity. So it's actually pretty easy to get to, because a lot of times it causes problems for people. There might be a tumor in the pituitary, and it might be secreting too much growth hormone or other kind of hormone, and it has to be ablated, it has to be removed. And so it's a relatively easy procedure, even though it's at the base of the brain, because all you have to do is pop through the sphenoid sinuses there at the roof of your mouth, and it's easy to get at. Then you just need some replacement hormone so you can have a normal life after that. All right, so we're interested in knowing the two main parts of the pituitary. Of course, you got the posterior, and the posterior is mostly what kind of tissue? It's, yeah, neuronal tissue, and you can see it has the same kind of color as the hypothalamus right here. And the anterior pituitary, on the other hand, is glandular tissue. Right. Both the posterior and the anterior secrete hormones. But you could guess that you might want to modify your understanding of the hormones that are released by the posterior pituitary because it's neuronal tissue. What do we call hormones that are released by neurons? Neurohormones. So it's better to think of hormones released by the posterior pituitary as neurohormones, but hormones released by the anterior pituitary are really true hormones because they're secreted by glandular tissue. Okay, and then we talked about the infundibulum, I think. What did I call the infundibulum last time? Oh, good. Yeah, the pedunculito. Yeah, because it looks like a little peduncle, all right, which is a bridge between two major parts of the brain, namely the hypothalamus and the pituitary. All right, so don't forget about the two parts of the pituitary gland. And I think maybe we even talked about this slide, I'm not sure, but here are the two nuclei responsible for synthesizing the two hormones released from the posterior pituitary, the paraventricular and the supraoptic nucleus. Now, why is this easy to remember as being the supraoptic nucleus? Yeah, because it's right above the optic chiasma. Right? So supra means on top of the optic nerve and optic tract, so that's the supraoptic nucleus. And then there, so these are where oxytocin and ADH are synthesized, and then they move down the hypothalamo-hypophyseal tract. They're stored in the axon terminals, and when an action potential reaches these axon terminals, these neurons release ADH or oxytocin, and then they're picked up by what kind of vascular element does this look like to you? That's a capillary, right, because hormones have to be, or neurohormones have to be picked up by a capillary because those are the only vascular elements that are thin enough that allow for exchange to take place. Okay. All right, so those are the two hormones released by the posterior pituitary. The anterior pituitary is controlled a little bit differently. Anterior pituitary synthesizes its group of hormones all by itself, but nonetheless, it's still controlled by the hypothalamus. Right here, the neurons of the hypothalamus that control the anterior pituitary, though, don't go all the way down through the infundibulum. They stop right at the floor of the hypothalamus. In this little area right here we call the median eminence. You don't have to know what that's called. right? And as a matter of fact, on the previous slides, when I talked about all the little other divisions of the pituitary, you don't have to be aware of. You should just know what posterior and anterior pituitary, and of course the infundibulum, because that's how the hypothalamus exerts control over the pituitary gland. Via tracts for the posterior, but via this circulatory system right here, which is a special circulatory system. What do we call this? Generally speaking, this circulatory system that is between two capillary beds without going back to the heart. Yeah, thank you. That's a portal. I kept asking you, but then kept talking. I was actually listening. Okay, that is a portal system, right? And indeed, that is the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal system. So it interconnects capillaries in the hypothalamus with capillaries in the anterior pituitary. And the neural hormones are released from the hypothalamus. They're picked up by that circulatory system, delivered to the anterior pituitary, where they cause the release of other hormones from the anterior pituitary gland. So these hormones from the hypothalamus, sometimes we call releasing hormones or releasing factors. And so now let's look at some of the hormones that are synthesized and released from the anterior pituitary. So we see that there are basically six of them that are grouped into five different categories. And the first one right here is prolactin. Prolactin operates during gestation. What does gestation mean? Gestation is when you're pregnant. Gestation is when... Gustatory is the sensation of taste, but gestation is when, right, there is a fetus developing in utero. And so prolactin then is released from the anterior pituitary and it goes to the breast and it causes development of the glandular tissue of the breast so that after parturition or after delivery, that breast can be used as what? A supply of nourishment for the infant. But that glandular tissue has to develop and it's prolactin that allows the breast to develop. Prolactin is not responsible, though, for milk letdown reflex or for ejection of milk from the breast. That's a different hormone, and that comes from the posterior pituitary. What hormone is that? That's oxytocin, right? So two hormones are necessary for that infant. Prolactin during gestation and even after parturition, and then oxytocin to make the milk letdown reflex happen. All right, so prolactin's effect is on the breast. Growth hormone, sometimes we call that GH, promotes the development of bone, muscle, and adipose tissue. And thyroid-stimulating hormone is a trophic hormone that maintains the thyroid gland. And the thyroid gland, did we talk about the hormones of the thyroid gland? Thyroxin, there are two different kinds of thyroxin. There's T3 and T4. And thyroxin needs an element in order for it to make it active. There is an iodine. Yep, so T3 has got three iodines. T4 has got four iodines on it. Don't forget, these are lipid-soluble hormones. They're carried by globulins in the blood. All right, but in order for the thyroid gland to secrete thyroid hormone, it has to be stimulated by thyroid-stimulating hormone. Without TSH from the anterior pituitary, the thyroid gland is going to regress. Or, if there is too much thyroid-stimulating hormone from the anterior pituitary, guess what the effect on the thyroid is going to be? Yeah, it's going to overstimulate the thyroid and it's going to hypertrophy. It's going to get bigger. And it's going to try to produce more thyroxin. And we're going to look at a case where the thyroid gets really big, even though it is not releasing a competent thyroid hormone, it still gets very big, hypertrophies, and we call that a goiter when somebody has a big mass right here due to that hypertrophied thyroid gland. So just like the thyroid gland, the adrenal cortex needs a constant signal from the anterior pituitary to maintain itself, and that is called adrenal corticotropic hormone. So these are all trophic hormones, which means that these are necessary to maintain the health of these target tissues right here. And what part is the adrenal cortex? Do I have the cursor on the adrenal cortex? I do not. What part do I have the cursor on right now? The adrenal medulla. What does the adrenal medulla secrete? This is a good quiz for the test coming up. Yeah, epinephrine and norepinephrine, primarily epinephrine, So these cells of the adrenal medulla are really like, are acting like the postganglionic cells of a sympathetic pathway, right? So when the preganglionic fiber releases acetylcholine on these cells, we call them chromaffin cells, they depolarize and then release epinephrine and norepinephrine. They don't carry action potentials to other parts of your body. They just automatically release epinephrine and norepinephrine. The adrenal cortex, on the other hand, needs stimulation by ACTH, or adrenal corticotropic hormone. And we'll see some hormones that then are released from the adrenal cortex. And then down over here, we have some gonads, the testes and the ovaries. These are the primary reproductive structures in, for male and female reproduction. There are gonadotropins that are necessary to maintain the function of these structures, and there are two gonadotropins, follicle-stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone. Both of these play important roles in male as well as female physiology, and the next slide talks about these things, but FSH is important for the development of a follicle in the ovary right here once a month. And what develops inside a follicle? Okay. A follicle, yeah, okay. And a hair follicle here, yeah, because we talked a lot about hair cells and all that kind of stuff. Pretty good guess. But in this case, it would lead you astray. All right, the follicle, okay, is, and so I'm glad I asked. A follicle is something in which a female gamete will develop, like an oocyte or an egg, all right? And an egg is, it has half the amount of DNA that a human has, right? An adult or child or whatever. And so an egg has to be fertilized by a sperm that comes from a testes right here. So a sperm is a male gamete, and an egg is a female gamete, and a follicle is what produces a female gamete. And one of those every month has to develop. Okay, and that process is promoted by follicle-stimulating hormone. All right, now that egg that develops once a month in the ovary can't be fertilized inside the ovary. It has to be ovulated. It has to be released from the ovary, and we call that ovulation. And the hormone that triggers ovulation is luteinizing hormone. So there's a big spike in luteinizing hormone, which causes the expulsion of that egg from a mature follicle, and the egg makes its way down past the fimbria into the fallopian tube. And in the fallopian tube, that's where fertilization can take place. And then after fertilization, it makes its way to the uterus for implantation. All right, so what do objects have to come together for fertilization? Just to make sure. An egg and a sperm. That's right, egg and a sperm. Okay. Okay. In the male, FSH is responsible for spermatogenesis. It stimulates and supports spermatogenesis. And LH is important because that's what tells the testes right here to synthesize and release testosterone. All right, so LH is important. FSH and LH are important in the male as well. Okay, so here are the hormones from the anterior pituitary. GH, growth hormone, promotes growth. Thyroid stimulating hormone stimulates the thyroid to secrete T3 and T4. Remember, T4 is primarily what's transported in the blood, but that's not the active form. Which is the active one? It is T3, that's right. So T4 gets converted into T3 inside of a cell. ACTH stimulates the adrenal cortex to secrete cortisol and aldosterone. A couple other hormones that we're going to look at a little bit. And then FSH stimulates growth of ovarian follicles in the female, sperm production in the male. LH causes ovulation in the female and the secretion of testosterone in the male. Prolactin, of course, stimulates milk production in mammary glands. I don't know of a good role to tell you for prolactin in the male. Okay. Okay, so the release of these hormones from the anterior pituitary is controlled by the hypothalamus. So there are neurohormones released by the hypothalamus that control the release of the anterior pituitary hormones. And so the hormones, the neurohormones from the hypothalamus, we call releasing factors, right? Or releasing hormones. Okay, so where can we see those? The releasing hormones come from the hypothalamus, and then they travel via this portal system to the anterior pituitary, and then they cause the release of the trophic hormones from the anterior pituitary. So it's not too hard to remember what some of these structures are. What does that kind of look like? I meant that to look like a thyroid gland. Okay? A thyroid gland. What hormone stimulates the thyroid gland into producing a product? I tell you why. What does a thyroid gland produce? It produces? Yeah, thyroxine, which is T3, right? And T4. What causes the release of T3 and T4? Yeah, TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone from, and I'll just kind of draw it the same way, from what, the anterior pituitary, right, comes from the anterior pituitary. What causes the anterior pituitary to release TSH, which goes to the thyroid gland? Okay, the hypothalamus. So the hypothalamus is going to be up over in this region, and then there are some capillary beds over here, which then connect up to the second capillary bed in the anterior pituitary. But there's a neurohormone from the hypothalamus, and that neurohormone, we call it a releasing hormone, right? And it's going to cause the release of TSH. That releasing hormone is called TSH-RH, thyroid stimulating hormone, releasing hormone. Some books call them releasing factors. So we could actually call these TSH, what, RF. So you'll hear both. I don't think there's a uniform nomenclature for naming them. All right, so you should be aware of these neurohormones from the hypothalamus, yeah?
The book actually
just thyroid releasing hormones. Well, yeah, you might even find other nomenclatures, okay? All right, so what about the gonadotropins, FSH and LH, right, which both go to the gonads, right, that stimulate the gonads. So FSH and LH, okay, come from the anterior pituitary. What causes the release of these gonadotropins from the anterior pituitary? Yeah, so we would call these GnRH, right? Gonadotropin releasing hormones, or maybe you want to call them gonadotropin releasing factors. Let's look at one more example to see how easy it is to see this. What about another organ? How about this one here? That kind of looks like the adrenal gland, okay? And then this part is the adrenal cortex. What stimulates the adrenal cortex? ACTH, from where? From the anterior pituitary. What causes the release of ACTH from the anterior pituitary? It's going to be, another arrow, really confusing. It's going to be what? ACTH, what, dash? RH. All right, so the RHs go through the portal system down through the infundibulum to the anterior pituitary. Okay, so all of them are controlled by releasing hormones or releasing factors. Okay, so this one right here might be an exam figure. I can't remember for sure if it is or not. All right, but this is just shows the feedback control over the anterior pituitary. It involves short feedback loops and negative feedback and long feedback loops. So here is the hypothalamus, and let's just talk about the gonads releasing sex steroids. And of course, in the female, it's going to be estrogens and progesterone, and in the male, it's going to be testosterone. That's a kind of androgen. All right. So what causes the release of these sex steroids from the gonads? Well, it's going to be the gonadotropins, FSH and LH. and these come from the anterior pituitary. What signals the release from the anterior pituitary? It is what? Gonadotropin-releasing hormones. All right. Okay, so when estrogens and androgens are released from the gonads, of course, they go into the blood, and they go everywhere in the body, including where? The pituitary gland and the hypothalamus. Okay, and so there is a set point in the anterior pituitary that knows what the proper level is of testosterone or estrogen, and as the estrogen and androgens move into the anterior pituitary, that level then is going to be compared with the set point, and if these levels are at a sufficient level, then this is going to make a nice negative feedback loop, which is then going to reduce the amount of gonadotropins released, which then is going to cause the gonads to secrete less, which then will maintain estrogens and androgens at their proper level, right? So this is a nice negative feedback mechanism that maintains, what, homeostasis for the proper level of estrogens and androgens in somebody's body. But that's not the only place it can feed back. It can feed back to the hypothalamus. So there's another set point in the hypothalamus that knows the proper level of these hormones, and then the hypothalamus adjusts its release of GnRH so that the proper levels of estrogens and androgens are maintained within the body. So this is another nice negative feedback loop. Now, these feedback loops do change in the female, and that's with response to estrogens right here and LH. Right at mid-cycle, remember that oocyte has to leave a follicle, a mature follicle, and the signal that causes that release is a big spike in LH. All right, and during that particular time, this usual negative feedback cycle turns into a positive feedback cycle right at the mid-cycle of the ovarian cycle in the female, so that when estrogen starts to increase as the follicle matures, estrogen increases, and then it feeds back in a positive manner to the anterior pituitary, causing what? A further increase in LH. And as LH increases and FSH increases, but primarily LH increases, that causes more estrogens to be produced, and it still maintains a positive feedback loop. So when estrogens increase, that causes an increase in LH, and that causes an increase in estrogen, which causes an increase in LH, which causes an increase in estrogen. Okay, so you can see that both levels increase, especially LH, dramatically. So why is it that the whole universe isn't filled with LH and estrogen? I mean, if there's a positive feedback cycle that happens and everything increases, it causes the increase of another hormone, which causes an increase in estrogen, how come the world isn't just filled up with estrogen? What happens? Something drastic happens, and that is ovulation takes place. All right, so a follicle then ovulates that oocyte, and then this turns back into a negative feedback loop, and then that drives LH back down to a lower level. But the follicle disappears at ovulation. It becomes another structure if we get to the reproductive system that we can talk about, and that's called the corpus luteum. The corpus luteum doesn't secrete estrogen, it secretes progesterone. Right? Well, none of that is on the slide, but you should at least be aware that this negative feedback cycle changes at mid-cycle into what? A positive feedback. So here is an example of a positive feedback mechanism that is normal. It's not a disease state, but this is an everyday, not everyday, but once a month normal occurrence. Okay. What kind of feedback loops are normally responsible for maintaining a healthy state? Negative feedback, right? So here is just an example of a positive feedback that operates over a short period of time to produce a normal state. Okay, so the hypothalamus, of course, is part of your brain, part of your diencephalon, and it receives input from higher brain centers, like your cerebral cortex. And what's going on in your cerebral cortex? That's where your conscious mind is located, right? So that's where you appreciate your everyday events, and everything that you're appreciating in your everyday life does affect the hypothalamus, because there are neurons that there are association neurons between those major centers. All right, so the higher brain centers can affect the anterior pituitary via those releasing hormones. So emotional states, psychological stress can affect circadian rhythms. Those are what, day and night cycles, sleep cycles, menstrual cycles, and even adrenal hormones. And we got to talk about adrenal hormones yet. Okay, so things that you are experiencing in your life will affect all these other different parts of your body through your neuroendocrine system. All right, then just to kind of reiterate, the posterior pituitary has two hormones. Those are ADH and oxytocin. ADH has another name, vasopressin. Vasopressin can increase blood pressure, so any kind of pressor agent is going to increase blood pressure. ADH works also to increase your blood pressure by another method, and that is ADH. What does ADH do on the kidney? What's the effect of ADH on the kidney? It makes you retain water, right? Makes you retain water. And so we say it conserves water, so you don't have water loss through the kidneys. It causes the kidneys to produce very minute amounts of urine that are very concentrated, right? So that you don't lose water. And when you retain water in your cardiovascular system, that water stays in your blood vessels, that has an effect on blood pressure. And you should probably have a feel for what that effect on blood pressure is. And a really easy way to think of this is if you have tires on your car, okay, and the pressure is low, what do you do to the tires? Do you take air out or you put air in? You put air in, right? So it's the same thing in your body. If we put fluid into our blood vessels, guess what happens to our blood pressure? It's going to go up. If we take fluid out of our blood vessels, what's going to happen to blood pressure? It's going to have a tendency to decrease. There are other control mechanisms that we're going to look at, but it's really basically kind of simple just like that. Okay? So ADH can help control blood pressure by adjusting the amount of water that we have in our bodies. Oxytocin stimulates contraction of the uterus during parturition. All right, so it's a very powerful, smooth muscle stimulant. There is a pharmacological oxytocin. Anybody know what the kind is in the hospital if you were to get a shot of this stuff to induce labor, for instance? Nobody knows? I forgot what it's called. Pitocin, okay, which is basically just oxytocin. It might be a genetically engineered form because, of course, if we want oxytocin, we probably got it initially from cadavers, but who wants to sit around and grind up brains all day long just to get oxytocin? So we found the gene for oxytocin and then taught bacteria. We transformed bacteria with that gene, so bacteria then will sit around all day making oxytocin and secreting it into a test tube, and then that oxytocin can be recovered from a test tube, and it's a lot cheaper to do that. Plus, we can never convince anybody to let us grind up their pituitary glands to get oxytocin, right? So it was only from cadavers. So that's one nice genetic engineering technique. And then oxytocin is also important for the milk ejection or the milk letdown reflex. And that's very important because the nipple does have sensory neurons that go to the hypothalamus, right? So for instance, when an infant is nursing, when it starts to nurse, those action potentials go to the hypothalamus, and the hypothalamus says, oh, your baby is nursing, then we're going to cause ejection of milk from the glandular tissue that's been prepared, that's been hypertrophied due to prolactin. So this oxytocin causes the smooth muscle around that glandular tissue to release milk. And then what happens to the infant when there is milk on a nipple? Does it get disinterested? Or does it become interested? It becomes interested, which does what? That causes more stimulation to go to the hypothalamus. Hypothalamus then causes the posterior pituitary to release more oxytocin. And then what does the infant do? Even that's stimulation to the infant, right? So it nurses even harder, which causes more stimulation to the hypothalamus, more oxytocin release. So what kind of feedback loop is that? That is? Yeah, that's a positive feedback loop. So here's another example of a nice, normal, positive feedback loop that maintains what homeostasis over the short run. But again, when you have positive feedback, you have everything elevating and elevating and elevating. How come the whole universe isn't filled with breast milk? Because the breast only has a finite capacity to produce milk, right? And then when the breast runs out of milk, what happens to the infant? It just goes to sleep, right? And so that breaks the positive feedback loop, and then everything gets reset after that. Okay, so the paraventricular nucleus right here is the one responsible for producing oxytocin. The supraoptic nucleus is responsible for ADH. All right, so you probably learned in anatomy that the hypothalamus is also important for regulating thirst and hunger, right? And it helps regulate thirst via this nucleus right here, the supraoptic nucleus, and the release of ADH, because ADH also gives you the sensation of thirst because you need to increase your water inside your body. All right, so the reflexes that we just talked about, we call those neuroendocrine reflexes, like the milk letdown reflex. That's a neuroendocrine reflex because it requires what? It requires nerves from the breast up to the hypothalamus, but it also requires hormones like oxytocin. So that's a nice neuroendocrine reflex. All right, let's look at the adrenal gland. And the adrenal gland sometimes is called the suprarenal gland. That means it's right on top of the kidney. And you can see the adrenal medulla, and then superficially the adrenal cortex. And let's take a look at a nice histological section of the adrenal cortex. On the outside of the adrenal gland is the capsule, connective tissue capsule, and then the zona glomerulosa. Deep to that is the fasciculata, and then even deep to that is the reticularis layer. And these are responsible for for release of aldosterone and cortisol and even some androgens. And this is the layer right here that is maintained by adrenal corticotropic hormone, or ACTH, not the adrenal medulla down here. Okay, so of course the medulla releases primarily epinephrine, okay, and that's controlled by sympathetic activity to the adrenal medulla. The cortex is controlled by ACTH. Where does ACTH come from? That's one of those anterior pituitary hormones, anterior pituitary hormones. And that causes the release of basically three kinds of hormones. Now, these are all steroids. So what's the foundation molecule or the precursor molecule for all steroids? That is cholesterol, right? So they're all going to be related to cholesterol. The first one right here, cortisol, is a glucocorticoid. I don't have that on the slide right here, but you might want to jot that down. Glucocorticoid. So when you hear gluco, what are you thinking about?
Sugars.
Yeah, sugars, like glucose, for instance. All right, so cortisol inhibits glucose utilization and stimulates gluconeogenesis. So it boosts, that's probably what you're looking at in lab this week, it boosts blood or plasma glucose levels. Right, because it diminishes utilization but promotes gluconeogenesis. What's gluconeogenesis again? It's the reverse of glycolysis. Yes, the reverse of glycolysis, right? When pyruvate or other molecules go backward up to making glucose. Right, so we call that a glucocorticoid. Aldosterone, on the other hand, stimulates the kidneys to resorb sodium from urine. So if there is no aldosterone signal, your kidneys will secrete a lot of sodium and you'll lose it in the urine. Right? Aldosterone will help you resorb it and put it back into your circulatory system. And when that happens, there's another molecule that comes along with it. What molecule likes to go from a low solute concentration to a high solute concentration? Okay. And that would be a solvent molecule. Likes to go from a low solute to a high solute concentration. So when sodium is reabsorbed by the kidneys, so is water. Water is reabsorbed. So ADH and aldosterone have synergistic effects. Right? These two hormones work together. And then what would be one overall effect on your body if you were to resorb a lot of water or maintain a lot of water in your body? It has to do with blood pressure. And which way would your blood pressure go? It would be maintained or it would be raised as a result of that. So aldosterone is very important for controlling your blood pressure, okay, because it retains, it helps your body retain salt. And maybe sometime in next month, you might actually eat a lot of sodium. Okay, maybe during Cinco de Mayo, for instance, when you have a lot of margaritas, and what's on margaritas? A lot of salt. How do you feel the next day? Maybe if you were to measure, yeah, maybe it's hard to, you're going to feel, yeah, feel really good, but you'll probably feel real puffy because of all that sodium that you ate. You're going to retain a lot of water, and probably if you were to measure your blood pressure, it would not be on the low end, right? It would probably be on the higher end than what it is normally. Okay, aldosterone has another effect on potassium, and it's the opposite effect compared to sodium. All right, so aldosterone causes the reabsorption of sodium from urine, but aldosterone causes the secretion of potassium into the urine, and then of course when it's in the urine, you do what? You excrete it from your body. It causes potassium loss. All right, so that might be kind of hard to remember this, but you know what? If you ever see on a board question someplace, what's the name of the hormone that causes opposite effects on body sodium and potassium levels? You should just automatically say aldosterone. Okay, if you ever see a question and it has the opposite effect on sodium and potassium, you should just automatically say aldosterone, even if you can't remember which way it goes. Okay, all right, and then the adrenal glands also produce some androgens. We'd call these sex steroids right here. So, but everybody produces androgens, and that's important for maintaining sexual behavior as well as aggressive behavior. All right. So you would think, well, maybe females don't produce a lot of androgens because ovaries produce estrogen and progesterone. But do females ever exhibit aggressive behavior? More so than males. In relation to what? Like protecting young, for instance, or something like that, right? So, I mean, females do need to have androgens for those kinds of behaviors, and they come from the adrenal cortex, not from the ovaries. So you can see that in these different regions of the adrenal cortex, the molecule that's necessary for synthesizing these hormones is cholesterol, and in every particular case, but here you can see the zona glomerulosa produces aldosterone, right, which is what, a mineralocorticoid, because it adjusts sodium levels inside your body. Cholesterol is also the precursor molecule for the glucocorticoids like cortisol and corticosterone from the fasciculata, and the zona reticularis, right, is responsible for making androgens. So on this slide, I don't want you to memorize all of these different compounds and which ones produce the next down the line. You should just be aware that the adrenal cortex does produce these three different classes of steroids, and they're what, all lipid-soluble, and they all come from cholesterol, so all of these hormones right here are related to each other. And you should probably know that androgens come from the reticularis, cortisol comes from fasciculata, and aldosterone comes from the glomerulosa layer. All right, but you don't have to know all of these different progressions through this metabolic pathway. Okay, adrenal medulla. I guess I will say a couple things about the adrenal medulla. The hormonal effects of epinephrine last about 10 times longer than norepinephrine. The adrenal medulla is innervated by the preganglionic sympathetic fibers. This is kind of a review for you guys from the autonomic nervous system. And the adrenal medulla is activated during the fight or flight response. So what are some physiologic responses that would be proper or appropriate during the flight or fight response? What about respiratory rate? Yeah, you should increase because you're going to need a lot of oxygen to generate a lot of ATP to support muscle activity. All right, increase heart rate and increase cardiac output. Cardiac output is just the amount of blood that your heart will pump out per minute. And again, that increased heart rate and cardiac output will deliver that oxygen to the tissues. All right, so you need more circulatory response to support muscles when they're working. General vasoconstriction, which increases venous return. So blood vessels can constrict, and this is going to boost blood pressure. which is going to help circulation to muscles during the fight or flight response. And epinephrine is also going to stimulate glycogenolysis and lipolysis, so that's going to increase blood glucose levels, which again is going to support ATP synthesis and mitochondria in those exercising muscles. All right. And as a matter of fact, we looked at the effect of the alpha adrenergic and beta adrenergic receptors on a liver cell that is going to be involved in what? Glycogenolysis and then release of glucose into the blood. Can you remember that? What kind of receptor was in the liver that had to be activated before glycogenolysis takes place? There were two. Okay, there was an alpha adrenergic and a beta adrenergic. And probably you should remember the alpha adrenergic. Does that epinephrine actually have to enter the cell? No, there's a surface receptor. So what's the signal called inside of a liver cell? The second messenger. And you should probably know the alpha adrenergics work through one kind of second messenger and the beta adrenergics work through another kind of second messenger. What were the two second messengers? Calcium is one and cyclic AMP is the other. And someone said something about a phosphodiesterase. What does a phosphodiesterase do? It breaks down the cyclic AMP, the phosphodiesterase. Okay, so those are a couple classes of enzymes that you should be aware of relating to phosphorylation of some intermediates, like a phosphatase does what? Phosphatase removes the phosphate, a kinase adds a phosphate, and then the other one, the phosphodiesterase, just breaks down the cyclic GMP or the cyclic AMP. Cyclic GMP in our retina and other cyclic AMPs as used by second messenger systems. Okay, the thyroid gland. All right, this might be one of the last glands that we're going to talk about. All right, that's just located right below the larynx. All right, so that prominent Adam's apple in your throat, that's the larynx, and then right on either side and below it is a thyroid gland. And that secretes T3 and T4, which sets the basal metabolic rate. All right, so the basic utilization of glucose and ATP in your body is adjusted by T3 and T4. And, of course, T3 and T4 are also needed for growth and development. So if there's not enough T3 and T4 in somebody's body for whatever reason, the metabolic rate is going to be decreased, generally decreased, and you're going to feel lethargic, right? And since your basal metabolic rate is reduced, you don't need as much energy intake. So, but if you maintain your energy intake the same, okay, then you have a tendency to gain weight as a result of that, right? If the thyroid gland is overstimulated, it secretes too much T3 and T4, basal metabolic rate is going to be increased. It'll be very hard to maintain weight, and you'll be anxious and nervous. So the opposite effects take place. All right, so it consists of microscopic little sphericals, which we call follicles, little spheres inside the thyroid gland. The outer layer is filled with follicular cells that synthesize T4, and the interior of these little follicles is filled with colloid, which is protein-rich, which then can store T4. All right, so here is a follicle, a thyroid follicle. You can see it ringed by the follicular cells. And these cells produce T3 and T4. All right, and they can be stored within the colloid right here. But of course, in order to make the proper thyroid hormone, you need proper levels of iodine in your diet. All right, so iodine in the blood is actively transported into these follicles. Right, and then secreted into the colloid, where it's oxidized into iodine, and then it's attached to thyroglobulin, and then that thyroglobulin makes T3 and T4. Thyroid-stimulating hormone causes hydrolysis of T3 and T4 from thyroglobulin, and then it's released from the follicle. And then where does it go? because it's a hormone, it gets picked up right by the blood, and then it's carried by what, plasma carrier proteins, because T3 and T4, although they're not steroids, they are still lipid-soluble hormones, so they need a carrier molecule. They don't have a tendency to dissolve in plasma, because plasma is basically water. Okay. So there can be a number of disease states of the thyroid. Right, so the hypothalamus is going to release thyroid-stimulating hormone, releasing hormone. I guess that's the old way of saying it. Maybe I would say archaic way. Today we just call it thyroid-releasing hormone. But I like TSHRH a lot. That goes to the anterior pituitary. That causes the anterior pituitary to release thyroid-stimulating hormone, which goes to the thyroid gland, which tells the thyroid gland to hypertrophy, right, and get busy making, what, T3 and T4. Now, what does the thyroid gland need to do in order to make a competent T3 and T4? What does it have to have? Iodine. It's got to have iodine, right? All right, so if it does make a proper kind of thyroid hormone, then those hormones can feed back to the anterior pituitary, right? This is a nice negative feedback loop, and then that's the anterior pituitary is going to say, oh, the level is proper, I don't need to release so much TSH, and that's going to stop the stimulation of the thyroid gland to secrete more T3 and T4 until these levels decrease. And when these levels decrease, then the anterior pituitary is going to tell the thyroid, okay, go ahead and secrete a little bit more until the proper level is released. All right, so that's a nice negative feedback loop. But what happens if there's no iodine? Then the proper levels of T3 and T4 aren't going to be maintained because there is no iodine. Right? So the thyroid gland is going to try very hard to synthesize T3 and T4, but it can't. Right, and so if iodine is inadequate, you're going to have very low levels of T3 and T4. There is no negative feedback then going to the anterior pituitary, so the anterior pituitary is going to say, hey, thyroid gland, you better start making a lot of thyroxine. So the anterior pituitary is going to release excess amounts of thyroid-stimulating hormone. The thyroid gland is going to hypertrophy because it's going to listen to that signal from the anterior pituitary, and it's going to make a lot of incompetent thyroid hormone, which doesn't have any effect on the body. It's going to grow and get bigger as a result, and that's a condition that we call goiter. All right, so that's what happens when people don't have proper iodine in their diet. All right, so where did that iodine come from in a cosmological sense? It actually comes from, it's made by when a star supernovas. Okay? That's not important in a physiology class, but I think it's kind of interesting from a cosmological standpoint that we need these elements, and where did these elements come from? Billions and billions and billions of years ago in a solar system that's not even here anymore. That's kind of cool to think about that. Okay. All right, the parathyroid hormone is released from the parathyroid gland. Oh, do I have a picture of the parathyroid? The parathyroid glands are in the posterior thyroid. So if we look around back on the other side, there's two little glands on either side embedded in the thyroid gland, which are the parathyroid. Parathyroid means basically on either side of the thyroid. And they release parathyroid hormone. And what stimulates the parathyroid glands to release parathyroid hormone is decreasing blood calcium levels. Now, what do you need proper levels of blood calcium for? Well, for synaptic transmission, one thing we haven't looked at yet, that's muscle contraction, as well as bones, right? But if you were going to choose bones over having neurons be able to communicate with each other via synaptic transmission, what would you choose to have? You'd rather have strong bones. Okay. Well, you know what? Most people probably would say, I'd rather have a brain that functions than strong bones, and you know what? Your body makes that decision too. So it sacrifices bones to maintain control, neuronal control over your body. Okay. So parathyroid hormone goes to the kidney, and it causes resorption of calcium from the the kidney filtrate before it becomes urine, so you don't lose calcium in the urine. It stays in your body, so that increases blood calcium levels. Parathyroid hormone also goes to bone, and it stimulates certain cells in the bone to dissolve bone down. What kind of cell dissolves bone? It's an osteo something. It's called an osteoclast. Yeah, clast. Remember, there are three kinds. There's an osteocyte that you find in mature bone cells. An osteoblast builds bone. That's one way that I think about it. And the osteoclast breaks bone down. Right? So osteoclasts are activated by parathyroid hormone, and that dissolves bone down to get blood calcium levels back to normal. Okay? And then, of course, that stops the excretion of calcium in the urine. And then when blood calcium levels go back to normal, right, then the parathyroids have an integration center that can then turn this process off. So parathyroid hormones, right, cause the breakdown of bone, but it maintains blood calcium levels. Now, there are some hormones that work antagonistically to each other. And there is one that your book doesn't make a really big deal of. Do I have a slide of it? I sure don't. But I'll mention it right here, because if there is ever a mechanism, if there's ever something in your body that's very important to regulate, like maybe heart rate or blood calcium levels, it is controlled by antagonistic systems. All right, so we saw that parathyroid hormone causes an increase in blood calcium by stimulating osteoclasts. There's another hormone that causes a decrease in blood calcium when your blood calcium is too high, and that's called calcitonin. So you should write that in your book and know that parathyroid hormone and calcitonin are antagonistic to each other. Right? Calcitonin does what? We're not exactly sure in humans, but it probably causes the deposition of calcium into bones. Right? Parathyroid causes bone demineralization. Calcitonin, on the other hand, causes what? Mineralization of bone or ossification. And so when somebody has, what's a prevalent disease that especially all women will experience as they get old? Osteoporosis, right? All men will too, but men generally have the ability to lose more bone mass before it becomes clinically important because their bones are bigger to start with. All right, so again, here there's just a little bit of an imbalance between what osteoblastic activity and osteoclastic activity that is regulated by calcitonin and parathyroid hormone. So I'm not sure why somebody with osteoporosis just can't get a shot of calcitonin to build their bones back up. I don't know what the problem is with that, but if somebody wants to do a Google search and actually find out why that is, I'm not sure. Maybe it stimulates bone so much that maybe it's tumorigenic. Maybe it produces tumors or something. I'm not really sure, but that sure would be a nice way to prevent that process from going astray. So something is wrong with this antagonistic system as we get older. All right, so let's just reiterate. What does parathyroid hormone do? It increases blood calcium. And what does calcitonin do? It decreases blood calcium levels. And those working together in normal physiology produce what? Just the proper level of calcium levels in your blood. Okay, well, that's kind of a nice introduction to the next topic, and that is the job of the islets of Langerhans. All right, and these are in the pancreas. Oh, I didn't tell you where calcitonin is secreted from. It's secreted from the thyroid gland, but not from the follicles, not from these guys, but from the cells that are outside the follicles. Sometimes we call these parafollicular cells. Okay, so it's secreted from the thyroid gland, calcitonin from the thyroid gland. All right, there are cells within the pancreas, and let's just remember that the pancreas has this big duct right here. This is a pancreatic duct, and then there's a little auxiliary duct right here. So part of the function of the pancreas is, what kind of gland has a duct? Exocrine. So part of the pancreas has exocrine function. It synthesizes and releases digestive enzymes into the small intestine right here. All right, but that doesn't relate to our chapter because we're talking about the endocrine system right here. Another part of the pancreas is an endocrine function in that there are little islands of cells that secrete hormones. And there are two types of cells, there are alpha cells and beta cells in these little islands of Langerhans that secrete a product, and that product doesn't go into the duct right here, into the pancreatic duct. It gets picked up right by the capillary, by the blood, right, by into the circulatory system. So those products are hormones. Those two hormones are insulin and glucagon. And the two different cells right here, the alpha cells release glucagon and the beta cells release insulin. And this is not an exam figure. I don't expect you to be able to identify alpha and beta cells right here, though you maybe could. There might be a color difference. I don't see any difference between. Do you see a difference between this one here? Ah, red and blue. Those are good colors to choose if I were to choose them, but not for my own purposes, for your purposes. All right, so you got two different kinds of cells. Alpha cells secrete glucagon in response to low blood glucose. So what is glucagon going to do? Yeah, it's going to be antagonistic to insulin. It's going to promote gluconeogenesis and glycogenolysis, and so that glucose in the liver is going to end up in the blood to raise blood glucose levels. Oh, it stimulates glycogenolysis and lipolysis. Yeah, it says right here. All right, and so glucagon increases blood glucose via these mechanisms. All right, insulin, on the other hand, is secreted by the beta cells. And we already talked a lot about what insulin is, but basically you should think of insulin as a passport that allows glucose to enter cells via what kind of transporter mechanism? How can glucose enter cell? What kind of membrane transporter is necessary? Yeah, what kind of protein is necessary? Yeah, the GLUT4 transporter. And how does that GLUT4 transporter work? What kind of transport process? Is it active or passive? It's just passive. What's a passive transport process? Diffusion. But when you have a transporter molecule moving something by passive transport across the cell membrane, it's a special kind of diffusion. We call that, facilitated diffusion. Right? So, and insulin allows for the insertion of those GLUT4 transporters into the plasma membrane, so cells can take up glucose. All right, and then cells, when they take up glucose, it can be converted to glycogen. What's that process called? Glycogenesis, right, and also fat synthesis. And when cells take up glucose, that decreases blood glucose levels. So these cells can, the receptors for glucose are contained on these cells. So these cells don't need receptors. They really are receptors for glucose in the plasma. So when blood glucose levels increase, that the beta cells can monitor that. They're aware of that. And they release insulin as a result under normal circumstances. Okay, that insulin signal then causes increased cellular uptake of blood glucose. And what does that do to blood glucose levels then? Since it's leaving the blood, they go down. And that feeds back negatively in a negative fashion. Okay, to these beta cells, and then they're going to stop the secretion of insulin as a result, as blood glucose levels start to go down, because there's a set point in the beta cells, right? So that just maintains homeostasis. All right, as blood glucose levels decrease, it goes into the cell, then cells can take that glucose and make glycogen out of it. We see that happening in liver and in skeletal muscle. And also in adipose tissue, they will gobble up these glucose cells and make fats out of them, okay? And adipose cells just love to do that when there's high levels of glucose in the blood. Oh, that's the last slide. I guess this is an exam figure right here, okay? And then just remember that glucagon has the opposite effect. All right, so that's it for the endocrine chapter. So your lab this week kind of supports this last part of lecture today, doing that glucose tolerance test. Let me just look at the recorder and see if it's still on. Yes, it is. Because it's had a problem lately. It actually has a crack in the battery case. So that's it for the test. All right, so that's the chapter so far. So that means, let's see, today is Wednesday. That means we're going to have a lecture on Monday. I suppose we could have the test on Monday. All right. Now that puts everybody, that sometimes works to your disadvantage. Okay. So we're going to actually get a little bit of an orientation to 12. You don't have your notes right now, but I'm just going to review some things from anatomy that you should really be familiar with already. All right. And then on Monday, we'll get into the physiology of muscle contraction quite a bit. All right, what do I want to do? I want to come over here. Okay, so mechanisms of muscle contraction and even some neural control of muscle. So how many types of muscle are you familiar with?
Three.
Yeah, three, and those are?
Cardiac,
smooth, and skeletal, which are under voluntary control? Only skeletal muscles. Matter of fact, don't forget that's the only thing you really do have voluntary control of in your body. Everything else gets taken care of automatically. So let's just focus on skeletal muscles. Skeletal muscles basically have two ends, right? There's an origin and insertion. Don't forget which one is the more movable end. That's the insertion. The more stationary end is the origin. Why does one end have to be stationary? Okay. So that's right, in order for that muscle to pull and to perform some kind of motion. If both ends were to move around, you wouldn't have any control. So for instance, I don't know if any of you have ever had your car stuck in the mud or in a snowbank or something, and somebody said, well, I'll drive the car, you get out and push. Okay, yeah, it's more fun to sit in the car and drive than have somebody go push. But if you're going to push the car out of the mud or a snowbank or something, all right, so you're going to be standing on the ground and you're going to push on the car, in order for you to push the car, what do you have to tell me about your feet? They got to be stationary. If they slip, right, you can't exert any pressure on the car. So muscles work the same way. So one end of the muscle has to be stationary. It has to be grounded, you could think of it that way, in order to pull on another muscle. So if both move, nothing's going to happen. All right, so don't forget your basic kinds of motion. You got flexion and extension. And what other kind of motions do you have? Besides, yeah, you got rotation, you got supination, pronation, right? You should review all of those kinds of things. Circumduction. For physiology, it's probably important to know the difference between dorsiflexion and plantar flexion. And when somebody can't lift their toes up off the ground, what is that motion called, lifting your toes up off the ground? Dorsiflexion. Yeah, dorsiflexion. Okay, what is that a sign of when somebody can't dorsiflect? And how do you find it really easily? I'm just looking at the tips of your shoes, right? Because if you don't dorsiflect, what happens to the tips of your shoes? You drag your toes along the ground and your tips of your shoes wear out. And in our population, I'm checking here. What am I checking for? It looks like I'm looking at your shoes, but what am I really looking for? I'm looking for spinal cord damage. Okay, so if you can't dorsiflect, that usually means that what root is damaged or impinged? The ventral root or dorsal root? Yeah, it's going to be the motor root, which is the ventral root. Okay, so it's kind of coming back maybe a little bit to you. And when you're in our age group, that's not so bad, but if it's maybe your grandma or grandpa in that age group, when you can't dorsiflect because you have a little damage to your neuroanatomy, what's going to happen?
Trip.
Yeah, you're going to trip. And then you're going to fall, and in that age group, that is usually fatal, right? Because the convalescence period is really difficult. You usually end up in a nursing home, right? So just be aware of all those different kinds of motions. Most of these motions, dorsiflexion, plantar flexion, are antagonistic, right? And is that a good thing or a bad thing? That's a good thing because then you have nice motor control over your body, right? So, for instance, the biceps is a flexor. What's the extensor? Yeah, your triceps. So they work together so that you have nice, fine control over your hand. So that could be really important on a Friday night. Why? when that person with the blue uniform and the fancy badge and hat and sidearm pulls you over and says, with your eyes closed, put your fingertip on your nose. You want to have good antagonistic control to just to prove that you're not intoxicated, right? So antagonism is very... Huh?
Good proprioception.
Proprioception, yeah, and good balance and control over your body. So antagonistic muscles are very important, just like what? The antagonistic mechanism of glucagon and insulin, and what other two hormones that we just looked at? Calcitonin and parathyroid hormone for regulating calcium, plasma levels. And that was actually a whole chapter that we studied. What chapter was that? I think number 9, which was you have two nervous systems that are antagonistic to each other, that control almost everything in your body. And that what are those nervous systems? The sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous systems, right? Okay, so muscles use that same kind of control as well. All right, so here you have a muscle. Don't forget the muscle is an organ because it has nerves, nervous tissue, it's got connective tissue, it's got muscle tissue, and know all the different, how you would, the building blocks of a muscle organ really are, right? So if you're going to build a whole muscle, you need fascicles. What's the building block of a fascicle? Those are the muscle fibers themselves, the muscle cells. So you take a bunch of muscle cells together and you put them into fascicles. You put different fascicles together to give you the whole muscle organ. Okay, and then if we look at a muscle cell itself, another name for a muscle cell is called a fiber, because muscle cells are really long and narrow. They are macroscopically long. They could be maybe even a meter long, maybe, depending on the animal, at least a couple feet long in people. And the reason why that is because at one time during development, it was composed of thousands of cells that fused together into one cell, forming this long rod or fiber-shaped object. And as a result of all those thousands of cells fusing together to form a mature muscle cell, a mature muscle cell has many hundreds of nuclei that are left over from all those progenitor cells, right? So skeletal muscle cells are multinucleate as a result of that. And then the building block of a muscle fiber that gives the ability of this muscle fiber to contract or shorten is the organelle of contraction. So here is the fiber composed of all of these organelles for contraction, and these organelles are called myofibrils. All right, so a muscle fiber is going to contain many myofibrils. So these are rod-shaped organelles that go from one end of the muscle to the other, and they have building blocks as well. These are the proteins necessary for shortening of a myofibril, and those we call myofilaments. All right, so hopefully this is coming back to you, and you should know two important kinds of myofilaments. What are those? Actin and myosin. One is a thick one, one is a thin one, and you should remember that they interdigitate, they overlap each other. Okay, all right, so what's the building block of a myofibril? Myofilament, yeah, and the two kinds of myofilaments. And then myofibrils can be used to make the muscle fiber, and then muscle fibers can be used to make fascicles, and then fascicles are used to make the whole muscle organ. Okay, and skeletal muscle is striated because why? Because you got all these different colored bands, and what do those bands make up? They make up the structural and functional unit of contraction of a muscle cell. So we talked about what's a structural and functional unit of life. That's a cell. A structural and functional unit of communication between cells is called a synapse. Yeah, and the structural and functional unit of muscle contraction is the sarcomere. So if you know how that sarcomere works and how it's controlled, you know pretty much everything about how muscle contracts and how it is controlled. And so these striations right here are just repeats of a sarcomere from one end of the muscle to the other, to the other, to the other. All right, and the dark band is what we call the A band, and the light band is what we call the I band. All right, and so just make sure that you know what filaments, okay, make up these different bands. I'll show you starting next week. Okay, so The neuromuscular junction is really what? It's a? I'm thinking of, starts with an S. It's a unit of communication between two cells, which is a? It's a synapse, right? So how does information move across a chemical synapse, and what kind of form? As a chemical signal, and a general name for that chemical signal is called a neurotransmitter, and a specific name for a neurotransmitter at the neuromuscular junction is acetylcholine, right? And so acetylcholine is used 100% of the time for neuromuscular junctions. And of course, that's not true in neuron-neuron synapses. How many different kinds of neurotransmitters do you know for neuron-neuron synapses? Well, you got norepinephrine, you got dopamine, you got serotonin, right? You got acetylcholine, you got gamma-aminobutyric acid, you got glutamate. So the list kind of goes on and on. Some of those neurotransmitters between neurons are excitatory because they produce EPSPs, and some are inhibitory because they produce IPSPs, yeah? But at the neuromuscular junction, acetylcholine always produces a massive depolarization, right? Never anything like an IPSP, but always a massive depolarization that's always going to result in contraction of the cell. So skeletal muscle can't ever make up its mind whether it's going to contract or not. When it gets a signal from a neuron, which originate, what part of your brain does that originate from? Well, we didn't get to talk about that in this class, but that's the frontal lobe, right, that initiates motor activity. When you consciously depolarize your frontal lobe, it goes down to the skeletal muscle, and so you say, okay, I want to pick up this marker right here. And you send signals to your arm to pick up that marker. Do those muscles in your arm ever say, no, I don't want to do it? No. It follows your commands, right? So skeletal muscle is under voluntary control all the time. Can't make a decision. All right, and so the synapse between a motor neuron and a muscle is what we call the neuromuscular junction, and it's very similar to the synapse that we've already looked at before. All right, the mechanism is very, very similar, except that the number of receptors, right, in the what we call the motor end plate of the postsynaptic membrane or the muscle cell, right, the density is very high, so that whenever there is release of acetylcholine, there are so many receptors that's going to cause such a depolarization that an action potential is going to take place. Right, so the graded potential is so high that it will always meet threshold and contraction will result. So you have mitochondria, you got synaptic vesicles. The only other difference between the neuromuscular junction and a typical kind of synapse is that when the muscle gets stimulated, what does it do? It contracts, it moves around, right? So there has to be adhesion molecules or structures that attach the Bouton terminale to the muscle so that the nerve never pulls away from the neuromuscular junction, right? Nerve connections don't have to worry about that because they never try to pull themselves apart. But neuromuscular junctions will try to do that. Okay, so that's why the structure looks a lot different, because you have many more receptors under the neuromuscular junction, and the motor end plate also has special adhesion molecules to make sure that things don't separate, because where you have receptor molecules is just right by the axon terminus. You don't have receptors over here. So if the nerve were to move away from the neuromuscular junction, you would lose control of that muscle. So this is what we call the motor end plate. All right, motor unit. I think you're familiar with a motor unit already. Okay. Motor unit is just a single motor neuron and all of the muscle fibers it innervates. And in this particular case right here, I see three individual muscle cells that are innervated by this one motor neuron. So when an action potential comes down, what happens to this muscle fiber that I have the cursor on right now? It's not going to contract. Okay, but what about this one? Yeah. It will contract, and this one will, and this one will. Okay. So that defines what a motor unit is, okay? And don't forget, motor neurons leave the ventral root, right? And the cell bodies of those motor neurons are in the anterior horn of the spinal cord, okay? And there's only one that goes, it doesn't need to, all the way down to this effector organ. Okay, and that innervation ratio, okay, can vary from 1 to 100 or 1 to thousands. That just tells you what kind of discrimination you have. If you need fine discrimination, you would like to have what? A large number of motor units with a very small innervation ratio. If it's a postural muscle where you don't have a lot of dexterity, you don't need fine control, for instance, over your back, right, then you have fewer motor units with a very large innervation ratio, okay, for just control. All right, so I think probably next time after the test, we're going to start, this is a good place to start, structure of a muscle fiber. So write that down. Oh, you don't have your notes. Write that down. I'll put the notes online. Oh, yes, so I'm going to lecture on this on Monday. That's right. That's right. We got a lecture Monday. Okay.